Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 7, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. Silicon Valley billionaires are donating millions of their own dollars to help school districts, but can all that money make a dent? Plus, we found a free website that can help teachers save or even make money on their excess classroom supplies. And taking a page out of medical doctor training, year-long residency teacher training is the new rage. But does it work? Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators with story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we have Greg Kasky. Mr. Kasky is teaching his students economics through rap. In fact, his curriculum is called Hip-Hoponomics, and he's here to share it with us today. Hey, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined with teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt, and we have education data expert Russ Davis of schoolstatus.com. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. The rumors of my demise have been greatly exaggerated.
We were worried about you. I think you were under the weather for a little bit, and then you were out of the country some. You've been all over the place, huh?
I was, and coincidentally, I was under the weather and out of the country at the same time. So imagine having a little bit of a language barrier and not
cold.
Being able to, yeah, and a, like not being able to have no voice. So it was awesome.
It's just, that's the way it works. I always get sick when I travel. Does that happen to you guys? Is it the airplane? What is it?
I travel for a living, and I'm pretty much sick all the time, but it could be the 21-month-old that's living in my house.
The walking germ.
Pretty much.
All right, so I was just teasing at the top of the show, we've got Greg Kasky with Hip-Hoponomics. Are you guys excited about this? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I've heard about it a little bit. I mean, I know something similar. I think he's actually probably pretty good, though.
I'm going to play a little clip, just a teaser, and then we'll talk to him later on the show, but take a listen.
Welcome back to class. Today we're going to learn about a principle that's taken for granted. I'm referring to David Ricardo's principle of comparative advantage. So please get out your notebooks and leave plenty of room in the margins.
Yo, this economic point is non-trivial and true. Old heads need to know where in the millennium.
All right, so that's just a little teaser of what we're going to talk about a little later on. We're going to actually talk to the person who's made all these rap songs to try to inspire his students about economics. What do you think?
Yeah, we're kicking it up in here.
Alyssa, I know we normally kick off the teacher's lounge with you, but since Russ has been out of town for a little bit, we're going to let Russ kick off the teacher's lounge and kind of tell us what scoop he's hearing. Russ, what do you know?
Well, I, in my absence, obviously, since I could not speak, I had a lot of time to do some reading, and I'd read an article in the New York Times recently that's talking about, the title is "The Silicon Valley Billionaires Remaking America Schools," and it's talking about Mark Zuckerberg and Reed Hastings and, you know, several other...
And so people know Reed Hastings is Netflix and Zuckerberg.
Yeah, Reed Hastings is the CEO of Netflix, yeah. And Mark... Benioff, I believe is, or Benioff is the CEO or basically the guy behind Salesforce.com, which is huge. Pretty much, I'd say 80% of the companies that you deal with on a daily basis use Salesforce. It's a CRM software. But anyway, these guys have made their millions and in most cases, in this article, billions. And they are now they've turned their eyes to education. And, you know, working in education, we see this a lot where, you know, some billionaire gets the idea that, well, I have been successful in this segment, then I am going to, you know, be super successful in education, or we're going to change the way education works or looks or acts. And I'll be honest with you, the initial approach that a lot of these guys took, like Mark Zuckerberg, gave Newark, and this is, you know, not something that's new to me, but he announced in 2010 that he was giving Newark Public Schools $100 million gift, mm-hmm. which $100 million like is a lot of money, but it's I hate to say, it's not a lot of money in education, and it's especially not a lot of money in Newark, New Jersey, their schools.
So do we know what happened to that $100 million?
You know, it's been widely reported that, I mean, it depends on your perspective, but most people think that it was pissed away, which I hate to say it like that, but... You know, I think that there were some good things that came out of it, but certainly not the, you know, whenever it was teased, it was going to be this huge transformative change. And for the most part, they spent it on a lot of consultants. And I just don't think they have a lot to show for it. I mean, certainly Newark has not undergone the renaissance that they thought $100 million would bring. And so even if you're a billionaire, $100 million is a lot of money. But what most people don't understand is that schools are huge corporations. One of the schools we work with, or one of the school districts we work with, is a $320 million a year company. In fact, I met with a superintendent today that I asked him what their budget was, and it rolled right off his tongue at $140 million.
And let's stop for a second and just think about that. That means that you basically have school superintendents, and hopefully we have some that listen to the show, their responsibility or their burden or however you want to look at it is greater than a lot of CEOs. Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, not only do they have the, you know, the liability of having that much cash and kind of dictating where it goes, or at least there being a process for that, they also have students running around, which are most corporations don't have. So there's this tremendous liability that anytime you're dealing with kids, you know, you not only have this huge financial issue where you just have a lot of money, and when you have a lot of money, you can get into money trouble very, very quickly. Most districts operate on a pretty razor-thin margin. And as we've seen in the past few years, if districts don't pay very close attention to their finances, they can get in a hole very quickly that they simply can't dig out of. And it can happen as quickly as a year. And so, you know, I'm saying all that to say that $100 million is a lot of money. And it really is. I don't want to discredit that. But you're talking about pouring it into districts that sometimes have a budget of $500, $600, $700, $1 billion. And so it's huge. And so it's a little arrogant to think it's going to make a huge difference, whatever they're already spending X number of dollars. And I think, you know, some of these guys, the latest efforts are really around apps, right? Trying to create new ways for people to learn math, trying to create, you know, different programs like code.org, which is fantastic. It's teaching kids how to code. Mm-hmm. I think they have 57,000 teachers that participate. More than 100 million kids participate in code.org's free coding programs. And I think that that's a great place to start in teaching children how to code. But I think they have to be a little careful, because sometimes you think because you're successful in one area, then you would be super successful in another area. So it's like me saying, I'm a successful surgeon, now I'm going to go build a suspension bridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Two totally different things.
And even if I talk to lots of architects who tell me how to build a suspension bridge, I'm not going to necessarily be able to do that. And so you just have to be really, really careful
about what
you pick. You know? Yeah, I think Elon Musk, who has it's not a photographic memory, but it's I forget the term, photogenic or something like that. he can literally remember everything he ever read.
He's going to be a rocket scientist.
He literally taught himself rocket science. And you ask him, how did you learn rocket science? He goes, I read a lot. And he's dead serious. Like, he learned how to build rockets from reading. But I would dare say that while Mark Zuckerberg is very intelligent, so is Reed Hastings, you know, delivering, it's an amazing thing to deliver so much content into our homes every day, and to be I think I just read recently where Netflix is about to be the largest content creator or content source in the world. So larger than movie studios, basically.
Wow.
And while that's amazing, right, I think he would find an equally large challenge trying to change education in such a way that would have real lasting transformative change. And I think they've learned that $100 million at a time, while a lot of money to them, is not going to do it. I think they've drawn back a nub, essentially, in other philanthropic efforts with education. And now they're actually, you know,
they're playing to their strengths.
They're taking a different approach. And, you know, this is not new. Michael and Susan Delve spent a lot of money building data systems. The Bill Gates Foundation spent, you know, I think it was $100 million with the Carnegie Foundation, building a company called Emblem about 5 years ago that crashed. It's just, you know, it's hard, right? It's not just people aren't working hard at the problem or there isn't enough money. It's just a really hard problem to solve. And it's going to take a lot of very, very intelligent people helping what are already a lot of intelligent people working on the problem every day.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, Lissa, I know you've been following a story, almost kind of piggybacking off some other stories we've done in some past episodes about how teachers can get school supplies or maybe what to do with their extra school supplies.
Yeah, speaking of the tight budgets, you know, a lot of teachers are given like a certain amount of money from their state, you know, to use in their classroom, maybe $200, maybe $150. But the problem is they're not really given it until like November, but then it has to be spent by the end of the year. And so that leaves a lot of time in between there where teachers are preparing for the school year or whatever, where they don't have the funds even, you know, available to be able to use them. Anyway, all that being said, there's a website, hootofloot.com, that is started by teachers, kind of like one, you know, the one that we spoke of before, like the teacher swap. But this is an online, you know, anybody, you don't have to be in the certain area, anybody can sell gently used, you know, materials that the teacher themselves have used and are no longer needing and going to pass on to somebody else. Or, you know, you can sell things that were intended for student use but never got used and they've never been touched. And you can, you know, I've been on the website. You can go and do a search just in your area, right. You know, put in your zip code just to see, you know, what can I get around this area? I think it's a great resource, and it's definitely very well organized. Anybody, it's free, you know, for teachers.
It looks
teachers.
Like you can make money, I guess, on it.
Absolutely. It's free to sell and, you know, free to use. It's, you know, but yes, you definitely, you make the money for your efforts for selling. But also there's discounted, you know, prices and such instead of just going and buying something new.
I was running a quick test because I was like, is this website is anyone from my area going to actually be using it? And we don't live in the most populated of places. Typed it in, and sure enough, we had some hits within, yeah, you know, a decent radius from where we are. So,
is this kind of like the swap that you mentioned on the episode before last?
Yeah, it is, I think, but it's almost the online version where one, yeah, was more community-based.
Right.
Sure. That's,
yeah,
cool.
Anybody anywhere can do it. But it was started from the same kind of idea, a teacher saying, what do I do with all these supplies that didn't get used? How can I help another teacher that might, you know, not want to spend as much on something new? What if I put it up there? So her husband kind of helped her, you know, to start hootofloot.com.
All right. Well, good follow-up. Thank you much, Lissa. I've been kind of tracking a story, and, you know, I'm not the educator here, but this seems to make total sense to me, and I want you guys to push back. But you know how doctors, they do a year-long residency right kind of before they become, I guess, an official doctor. I guess you are a doctor, right? Russ, help me out here.
You're yeah, a physician, you're a physician, then you go through a residency program. But yes, you have to go through residency in order to get the next step.
And I think that's what they're suggesting teachers do in some communities where you actually become a teacher, but then you have to work with another teacher in a school for another year before you actually get your own class. Is that a bad idea or a good idea?
May I go first,
yeah,
Russ?
Yes,
you may. I know you've been gone.
You're going to have very strong opinions about this, I feel. I could feel it through the mic, through my earphones.
Let's
I can
assume
feel
you're
it.
Getting paid, though, like you're on you the job.
Okay,
yeah,
great. Yes, right. You should get paid if you're required to do that, sure. But I do think it's a little too late, you know? I feel like if they're going to initiate something like this, that's a great idea. But they need to do it on the front end. Meaning, I mean, I know these teachers are not released out into the workforce yet, but I feel like they should be required to do it earlier on. You know, so many teachers or new teachers or teachers in training, you know, they get to their student teaching and they're like, oh, gosh, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. I don't even like these people. You know, that's what happens. And you don't want those people, you know, then what? They've spent all this money, all this time. And we don't need them. We, you know, we need people that want to be there. And I wish that they could see that they want to be there sooner. And also, I would make sure that you're shadowing the best of the best, because so many.
Are you saying there's some apples?
I am saying that there are some teachers out there that love for a student teacher to come because they could use the extra help, or they want to hand the class over. Here you go. You know, you take a swing at it. Let me rest for a minute. I think that that's not what student teaching is. I think that you're not learning from your mentor teacher if you're I think you should be doing it. Absolutely. You should be, you know, like, oh my gosh, I'm totally doing this by myself. And, you know, but I think if you're going to do a residency or whatever, you know, you should be able to truly watch and learn from some of the best.
Well, it made sense to me. But Russ, I'll let you go ahead. And
well, I probably have a little different view than Lissa, because I think it's actually not a bad idea.
And sorry.
One of the problems in education is that nobody fails their practicum ever. Like, people quit their practicum, but nobody fails it. Nobody that I can ever point to. I'm sure it happens in limited cases, but we kind of feel like, oh, they've been here for 4 years. You know, they've gone through they're kind of afraid to not give them that degree and not give them that teaching license or grant that. And I think that in almost every profession, think how many people, you know, flunk out of medical school. Think how many people don't become an architect. Think how many people, you know, don't do X, Y, and Z. And I think it's largely because in institutions of higher learning, I think that education often, and I this isn't maybe popular saying this, but I think it's like a class of last resort, right? If you can't do this and you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. Oh, yeah, you could become a teacher, which is complete and total bullshit. Like, it is a real job, and it is one of the most important jobs I can ever imagine, because you have someone's life and then their kid's life and their grandkids' lives in your hands, right?
Right.
So we should find people that are doing it for the right reasons. We should find folks that, you know, can cut muster. And if they can't pass their practicum, then, you know, too bad. I'm sure that there are people that flunk out of that, don't complete their residency, right? And that happens. So, you know, I don't take like this polar opposite view by any stretch of the imagination, but I honestly believe that it should be harder, not easier, to become a teacher.
I agree. And I do think there should be more organic experiences in the
practical
training of
knowledge.
Teachers.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, if a state made this, you know, year-long, you know, kind of situation, they still would wave those teachers on at the end of it.
I think that's
an ugly thing, but it's not the residency that I have a problem with. It's the, you know, the teachers that bring on student teachers that are not, they don't need to be the ones that we're shadowing, but also, you know, everyone would still get waved on, and people, the state would pat themselves on the back and say, well, we did our best to put them in the best situations and to show them what's out there and good luck, you know, because nobody's turning away teachers, truthfully, you know. And I agree, there should be higher standards, you know, but that's not going to change until you pay teachers more. And then there are going to be people that look at it with, you know, different set of eyes that says, yeah, you know, of course, everybody knows it's a noble profession, everybody. But if you're not going to pay people more, then you're not going to get those big hitters that would really be awesome.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that there are so many school districts that need teachers that some of them are willing to deal with a warm body, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so as long as that situation exists, then you're going to have folks that, you know, there's going to be this natural pressure on an IHL, on institutions of higher learning, to graduate more and more teachers and to put them in the classroom, even though, you know, there are two things that happen. One, most teachers, and I've never met a single first-year teacher who, after the first year, felt that they were like, ready to do their job, like that they felt on top of it and it went great and blah 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 blah. Like, most people I talk to, they laugh at you when you say that, because they were so unprepared to actually be a teacher by the time they spent 4 years learning how to be a teacher.
Right.
And I think that there are just these large systemic issues, just like we were talking about with these, you know, dot-com billionaires, that we can't solve every problem, but we do have to take a swing. Like, teacher quality isn't sexy, but it is something that affects every single child that's in a public education system. And finding, you know, good quality leaders and principals and superintendents, and also good quality teachers, should be a priority of every state. But I just think a lot of the time it's, we have a teacher shortage. Let's get some folks through this, and then we complain whenever the results aren't what they should be.
To me, it makes sense. I mean, and Russ, coincidentally, you were just kind of alluding to this. We were texting back and forth a few days ago, and you text me, the first time you do something, you're terrible at it. And mm-hmm. and that's for anything. And I think there's a lot of truth in that statement. There really is.
Yeah, I talk to every parent of a second child. Yeah.
Well, and I talked to a superintendent today, and he and I were just, you know, we were shooting the bull, but definitely we were, you get in situations where you look eyeball to eyeball and you can be completely honest with one another. And we were talking about some problems in education. And one of the things we talked about was, I said, well, a lot of first-year superintendents, there's no training, really. Like, there are some programs, like, for first-year superintendents that kind of help them, like, navigate some legal waters and that kind of thing. But especially superintendents in underperforming districts should be paired with very effective superintendents so that they learn how to do the job as good as that person does. But anyway, I talked to the superintendent, who I respect greatly, and asked him, I said, by chance, do you think you did a good job your first year as superintendent? And he was an elected superintendent, which is kind of a rarity in education. And he was like, hell no. Like, mm-hmm. I was terrible at it. But I got better at it, and now I think I'm pretty good at it. And I think that's true in every single thing. And I kind of joked with Nick, my wife works at a teaching hospital, and you never, like, you just generally don't want to have surgery in July, because on July 1st, that's the first day of surgery for all these guys that have had these front-loaded programs. There's going to be a very
good
shaky scalpel hand.
I'm going to lock myself in a room.
There's a very shaky scalpel hand that's going to be, you know, cutting on a live human being for the first time. At some point, it's everybody's first time, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And you hope that there are lots of qualified people that can show them the ropes, but a lot of the time, you know, in a lot of professions, folks are just kind of thrown to the wolves, and this is how I had to do it, so now you have to. It's almost like a hazing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't think teaching should be like that.
No, and it's never going to be super easy. I mean, no matter how prepared we are, you just, you know, when you get in there and shut that door, you're like, oh, goodness. And I know, even when you switch, even if you've taught for 6 years and you switch to a completely different grade or subject area, it's like your first year all over again, and you look at the end and think, okay, there's so much that I'm going to do differently next year. I know that I've always gone out of my way to help the new teachers on campus, because sometimes they don't even know things like just how to input grades, you know, or how to, you know, those kind of just normal basic things that just are so small that nobody has time to stop and show, you know. I think that any new teacher that wants to take a stab at it and has done the correct route and has the passion behind it, I would not tell them, oh no, don't do it. I would say, give it your best shot, and you're only going to get better from here. But I do think that there is so much more we could do to draw more effective people to the position of teaching, and it starts with, obviously, money.
All right. Well, definitely a good debate. I think everyone got a little heated on that one. I like it. Coming up next is our Bright Ideas segment, and we were talking about this at the top of the show. We've got a young teacher who actually is reaching his students through rap. Our guest in today's Bright Ideas segment is the creator of Hip Hoponomics, Greg Caskey. He is a teacher at the Delaware Military Academy, and he's teaching his students economics through rap. Greg, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me on.
We're pretty excited about this. And before we get too deep into conversation, I really just want to take a minute and bring our listeners up to speed with a sample of your work. So I'm tapped into your SoundCloud right now, and I'm going to play a little clip from one of your songs. Are you ready for that?
Wonderful.
With the Fed, inflation's being spread, messing with the interest rate, is getting businesses misled. With endless more ahead and bailouts going to their friends. Listen, man, the power of the US dollar's being bled. Yeah, what's up with the Fed? Inflation's being spread, messing with the interest rate, is getting
businesses. All right, Greg, now that's just a little sample of your work. We're going to probably listen to some more in a second. But really, what sparked this idea for you to try to reach your students this way?
Well, this comes out of my educational history and my experience, right? So I had a very inspirational high school U.S. history teacher, who her name is Joy Schillingsburg, And I had her for 10th grade U.S. history. And I recall her assigning my friends and I similar assignments where we had to take, say, 10 to 15 vocabulary words based off of, you name it, whichever concept, and we had to create something meaningful out of it to synthesize our knowledge rather than just show that we had memorized the content. And, you know, that always stuck with me, and my friends and I were always leaning towards the creative. So we really jumped at those opportunities to go all out to write songs about Charles Lindbergh or the New Deal or really whatever, right? Stuff about John Tyler. And that always stuck with me, and she really inspired me to get into the education world because I saw a model of what it looked like to be very passionate about your profession and influence others to do the same. And so that is where the initial idea started, but then when I began to student teach in a rather urban setting, I knew that this was going to work like hotcakes in there. And because I can rap pretty well, and my intent was to inspire them to do the same thing.
So let's be honest, you're kind of putting yourself out there a little bit.
A little bit.
You know, and did your students react to it the way you thought they would? Were they like, yeah, this is awesome, and or did they laugh at you, or were you worried about that?
No, I was not worried about it because, yeah, it's all about how you present yourself. If you, I think it's obvious to the students, because I view teaching as one 5-hour long performance every day, right?
That's exactly right.
If your students can tell that you sort of believe in yourself and sort of don't, I think they see right through that. But I think that I'm actually pretty good at rapping. I'm not the world's best rapper or anything like that, but I can do it, and I have albums, and I've been doing it since middle school, and I've performed for large audiences before, so it was never a matter of that. So
do you find that you're reaching people outside of your classroom?
Yes, so that's the really exciting part for me. So I have this summer to develop these lyrical lesson plans to go with each track off my last two albums that I intend to sell to teachers around the English-speaking world. But even before I've reached large groups of students, there's like famous economists with like over 100,000 Twitter followers that are retweeting my stuff, and Walter Williams, of course, the famous economist at George Mason, wrote a syndicated column about this that appeared in 150 newspapers like 2 weeks ago. And I do have some international listeners who've gotten in touch with me from the Netherlands, from Singapore, and from Senegal even, which is interesting. And yeah, so yeah, I chuckle about this because, you know, this began as my little graduate school project and has really blossomed into something that I could never quite have imagined.
So I'm going to play another little clip from a song. This one's called Free Enterprise System. I don't know if you like this one as much as I do, but I like the hook. I think this one is, it's Wu-Tang, right? Is that?
That would be correct.
C-A-S. K-E-Y, yeah, don't deny he's fly. Yeah, he's an economics kind of guy. Yo, ask why, well, let me supply. Yeah, he's a rapper in disguise, but just a teacher on the outside. Yo, got questions, well, let me advise. Yeah, keep the feds outside and let it flow, that's free enterprise. It ain't some mystery, it's a bird that flies. On its own, it's natural, like a baby that cries.
So what's kind of your most successful song? Is that one of them, or?
My most listened to song is called Debating the Wage, which is off of Hip Hoponomics Volume 1. And that is because Walter Williams, who I just mentioned, who wrote the column, I feature a soundbite from him in the track from his 1985 PBS special called Good Intentions. So he referenced that one in the track, and naturally a lot of his readers went and checked that song out.
So do you hear a song, like a current song, and think, ooh, that's a good one to lay the lyrics to? Or do you kind of have the lyrics and then you need to find the song? How's it go?
Okay. Yeah, so I sort of have this factory production process. I run a lot in the forests near my home. And when I get out there, a lot of my concepts come to me while I'm running in the forest or I'm doing open water swimming training, mostly in the forest, though. And I remember them and write them all down. And once I have them written down, then I have to go to Starbucks near my house. That's where all my writing takes place. I have to caffeinate with cold brew after cold brew, and they know what my baristas know what's happening, so they just come back with refills. And then after the lyrics come, which some songs are more arduous to write, some come like a lightning bolt, like my song Emergent Order.
Literally thousands of people cooperated to make
Adam Smith's key idea here that, you know, if people are left to be free, that they will behave in ways that are beneficial towards society, usually, right? So I open up with the song, my opening lyric in the song is based off of one of his famous quotes from his book, An Inquiry into the Causes of the Wealth of Nations.
It ain't the kindness of the butcher that gets you your meal, but regard to his own self-interest appeal.
Compassion. And where he said it's not from the kindness of the butcher that you expect your meal, but from regard to their own self-interest.
The invisible hand promotes greed, but here's a question, how else will you get the products you need? Clarifying points.
2017 translation, the butcher doesn't care about you, but because he wants to feed his family, he will serve you veal or beef or whatever you want. And basically that is the nature of most exchanges that take place in the world. And thus humanity is united through this network of exchanges that just emerges spontaneously. And I think that that's such a deep and rich insight that, you know, I think that that's the deepest idea in economics.
Of course, I know you know this. There are so many just, you know, fun teachers out there that want to make a goofy little song or something on YouTube to help teach some small thing to the in the classroom. And so many of them are really painful to listen to, but yours sound like, honestly, if I was sitting in Starbucks and I heard one of your, you know, drops, I might would be like, that's a real song. I don't know that I would think that it was.
I think,
you know,
a pretty sure giveaway may have been a Global Division of Labor, though.
The Global Division of Labor, ain't nothing about it mundane.
I think kind of shoehorned in. That would be
it would make
that would
tune
give
in.
Me the giveaway.
I would be like,
yeah,
wait
that
a minute.
Would be a dead giveaway. You're right.
Can you give me an example of an interaction maybe you've had with a student after they did listen to some of your work?
Yeah, so this is a great opportunity to explain the process. So I write these songs and I implement them in class. I'll perform them and then we'll go through the lyrics again. I'll give the copies of the lyrics to the students, especially for the debate tracks, are a really powerful teaching tool. So I have debate tracks on the minimum wage, on the Brexit, on free trade versus protectionism, things like that. We'll have like a T-chart on the board and we'll go through the lyrics and I ask them, hey, pull out all the key arguments on each side of the debate. And, you know, it really creates this sort of competitive academic atmosphere where the students are trying to outdo one another in terms of pulling out the deep insights, because some of them are really sort of inside baseball knowledge, like, you know, things that technical economists would understand reference-wise. But, and it's a joy for me to see the students have this sort of engagement. Usually what I do is they have to create their own hip-hoponomics track, right? And I incentivize performance through extra credit. I don't coercively make them all perform because that would be a nightmare for some students. Although I'd love to, some classes, like half the kids or more perform. Other classes, it's, you know, more of a task to get even a few to perform just because they're shy. And I usually say, you know, the best tracks throughout the year have a chance to get on my albums.
And how can people find you online if they're just
interested? Yep, so hiphoponomics.com is my website. And the way to think about how to spell that, it's economics, and take out the EC and put hip-hop in front of it.
All right, Greg. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time. Kudos to you and your idea here. Hopefully there's someone else out there maybe listening who has thought about doing something like this but just maybe didn't, you know, take that step. And I got to applaud you for taking that next step.
Well, thank you. It really means a lot to me, and I appreciate your time and love what you guys are doing on the show.
Thank you so much. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
I am.
All right, first question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject would it be?
Economics.
All right. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
I don't think we're teaching students to appreciate the world in all of its complexity. I think that students are, and I was like this too, only have a very limited view of the world and only are thinking in terms of like their high school or their state or something like that. So I really labor in the classroom to show that there's a whole wide world of billions of people in various cultures and idiosyncrasies and cuisines, and just have an appreciation for the peoples of this world. So, yeah, something like that.
What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves a dynamic educator who cares about their success and wants to invest in their lives.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
They're doing an impossible task, right? They're trying to be innovative and exciting and passionate in the classroom, but they have to do so in the context of potentially drowning in lots of meetings and paperwork and all this other stuff that, you know, no doubt takes away from their creativity and time to be passionate and, you know, innovative. And yeah, there's a real trade-off there that I think administrators need to think about.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Space to be creative.
What career path would you have taken if you couldn't be in education?
I wanted to be a pitcher for the Phillies, but then I had Tommy John surgery in college and my baseball career ended. So, but if not that, I would love to try to be a fingerstyle guitarist.
There you go. What teacher changed your life?
Joy Schillingsburg, my 10th grade social studies teacher at Abington High School, north of Philly.
Do you buy the school lunch or bring your own?
I bring my own.
And what do you do on your planning period?
I am usually joking around with other teachers, trying to focus, but with my undiagnosed ADD, it's very difficult.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Definitely a pencil.
All right, Greg, we again appreciate you taking the time to chat with us, and we'll be in touch hopefully in the future as your albums continue to blow up.
Yeah, well, thank you for your time. Expect Hip Hoponomics Volume 3 in the fall, and Volume 4 and 5 and subsequents coming after that. So thank you for your time, and you guys are awesome.
Don't forget us little guys.
Oh, jeez. Thank you.
Take care. That's going to do it for Episode 7 of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show. We'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. That's what keeps us going. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ Davis with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.